Hi, this is Robin Carpenter, and we're welcoming you for a special collaboration, another collaboration between the Farm and Food Shed Report and Post Carbon Radio with co-host Bing Gong, myself, and Karin Niehaus. I hope I got that right, Karin. In November 2014, the three of us interviewed leaders of the young agrarian movement facing the future. In today's special two-hour show, we'll take a deeper look at the relationship between agriculture and climate change. Our guests live right here in our community, but they're having an impact across the globe by making agriculture part of the solution. Today's guests are Nicolette Hahn-Nyman, who is an environmental attorney and the author of Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. We have Aaron Lucich, who is the founder of Holistic Ag and a documentary filmmaker. And John Wick is one of the founders of the Marin Carbon Project and co-owner of Nicasio Native Grass Ranch. Joining us a little later in the show will be Albert Strauss, who is the founder of Strauss Family Creamery, the first organic dairy west of the Mississippi, and one of the creators of Mindful Milk, a collaborative project to improve milk quality for dairy farmers in India. James Stark is the co-director of the Regenerative Design Institute at Commonweal in Bolinas, and he's one of the original founders of our very own KWMR Community Radio. Evan Wigg will also be joining us later, and he's the executive director of the Farmers Guild, which is a community of the newest generation of farmers, ranchers, chefs, artisans, and sustainable food systems advocates. In our first hour, we'll be focusing on busting some of the myths, grazing animals, compost, and soil carbon sequestration involved in agriculture. In our second hour, we'll be more oriented towards some of the practical aspects of creating change and implementing better agriculture in the face of the industrial agricultural factory farm paradigm. So we'd like to welcome everybody. And Nicolette, I think we might have a great starting point with you sharing a bit about one of the most prevailing myths today, which is that meat consumption is what's really destroying the environment. And as a vegetarian and environmental attorney, you really have a unique perspective. And in your latest book, Defending Beef, you really have a lot of great data and a thorough exploration of this. Can you talk a little bit to us about why you came to write Defending Beef and what was discovered that doesn't match up with sort of the modern mythology around it?
Yeah, there's a lot of sort of assumptions that people have in this conversation that's taking place in the public, and this notion that there's been this sort of increasing problem with water and soils and food production, and that that correlates to this sort of rising tide of more and more animals in our food system and more animals on the land is something, and on our plate, and that's something you just encounter over and over again. But the data is actually very different. It tells a very different story. In particular, when you look at the American plate, meat consumption has not been steadily rising over the last century. It's actually quite comparable to what it was 100 years ago. And in particular, red meat, which is part, you know, all the grazing animals, which are kind of the focus of a lot of the climate discussion, people are eating actually quite a bit less today than they were 100 years ago. And that number also correlates to the number of animals on the land. So the total number of cattle has declined quite a bit over the last century, largely because there are a lot fewer dairy cattle, and there are just a little bit more beef cattle, but not a lot more. And the total number of sheep has plummeted. It's gone from like 40 million to 5 million. So that's a dramatic reduction. And so there's just a much lower, there's a much smaller number of animals actually grazing the lands. So that's a very important point, I think, for people to understand. And in terms of grazing on public lands, I want to make special note of that. In the last 50 years, public lands total grazing has decreased by almost 60%. So that's a very important point, because when people see, you know, things degrading, they assume it correlates to increasing numbers. And that's just not true. The same thing, again, you know, we're not talking about that really today, but when you talk about public health issues, when you look at the total amount of red meat consumption and animal fat consumption compared to a century ago, it's actually lower today. So those are important facts, I think, to start the discussion with.
And one of the things, and perhaps Aaron or John might want to follow up, around the way, and I know, Nicolette, you covered this in the book, too, about what the amount of grazing animals that was on this land even before we showed up, and how that's necessary for a large portion of the planet's grasslands. And I don't know, Aaron, if you want to take that or John or jump it right in on that.
We could have a coin toss or maybe we'll alternate. we're probably, I think we agree on these things. The difficulty is that it's prehistoric. So you can get into these arguments, and a good friend of ours refers to himself as an ecological philosopher because he's wise enough to know that people are going to say, well, you can't prove that, right? So, but from an archaeological standpoint, we can surmise there were vast numbers of megafauna on this continent prior to the Pleistocene extinction event, which was a pretty significant extinction event. You're reacting.
You know, and I just think it's really interesting because I know that kind of falls into a lot of the work that John Wick did with the Marine Carbon Project, just to have each of you give a little bit of an overview of the regeneration created by the soil and by the composting and that kind of impact that they had.
Well, so this is John Wick speaking, and the question we asked in the beginning of our research in 2007 was whether our management of our grasslands could result in increased soil carbon. And at that point, science didn't know that answer, and there was no obvious measurement methodology available. Dr. Wendy Silver said she didn't think we could change soil carbon, and she didn't think that we could also measure that change. Our research has shown otherwise. Our thinking in the beginning was that grazing management was going to be the activity on our land that was going to increase soil carbon. To date, we have not yet been able to measure durable soil carbon increases from grazing. But in the course of the research, we tried to establish how could we detect changes of soil carbon, and we used compost purely as a scientific inquiry, and the results were astounding. And just to quickly summarize, what we were able to show scientifically is that we can increase soil carbon in a durable form, and that when you increase soil carbon, the system's capacity for even more carbon increases. And then after the initial soil carbon sequestration event, the system on its own starts sequestering carbon year after year after year from a single event. Very exciting. The challenge for me personally is how could we manage grazing events to also increase soil carbon? And that's what our continued research is looking at.
Can you also address this in terms of the drought, the impact that your study found in terms of water?
Yeah, the exciting thing, and this has been kind of a personal growth, is that looking at one particular thing is interesting, but when you back away and look at all of the relationships within a system, then the results become interesting. The cascade of measurable benefits included increased water holding capacity, 26,000 liters more water per hectare compared to an uncomposted plot, 50% more forage production of what turns out to be a more nutritious grass, and increased carbon cycling in the system.
And I think another thing to look at there is, and maybe, I don't know if Nicolette or Aaron can address this, but some of the research on desertification, which I always stumble on that word, and that Alan Savory has done, and some of the work on that, kind of back a little bit to what happens when you do have these large herds of grazing animals and how that kind of works ecologically.
Well, I'll start, and maybe Aaron will want to add something. So the theory behind Alan Savory's work and the thing that he's been observing and documenting in various places around the world, he's a wildlife ecologist who's spent several decades working on land restoration. And what he's shown is that the impacts of animals on the land are incredibly variable depending on how those animals are managed. And his argument and what his work tends to show is that when they're managed more as a wild herd would have functioned in the prehistoric and historically, that has a very different impact than a more laissez-faire, actually, attitude towards grazing, which is more prevalent today. And he's shown that when you have the animals closely bunched and when they're moved with a lot of frequency, that's more the way a wild herd would function. And in fact, if you, I always encourage people when they're thinking about this issue to envision footage you might have seen of the Cape buffalo moving across the Serengeti or the caribou in the Arctic, or the remaining American bison herds that still exist, which are a tiny fragment of what was once on the Great Plains. And you can just think of how grazing herds would naturally function when they were, in fact, in their much larger numbers that they were for tens of millions of years. And it's not really known what it is about grazing that has this impact, but some of the things that are believed to add life to the soil and increase water holding capacity, et cetera, is the fact that actually their eating of the vegetation is like a pruning action. Their pressing of their hooves is like presses soils into the seeds, which increases germination, presses organic matter into the soil, which makes it easier for the soil to act upon that organic matter. The organic matter is more easily kind of feeding the soils. And, of course, their cycling of the vegetation as vegetation into manure just kind of speeds up the whole biological process. So those are some of the reasons it's believed that the grazing animals can have this positive impact.
So this is Karin. I actually have a question about other players in the ecosystem and what their role might be in that dynamic, particularly dung beetles, I know, have played a great role in the past, and I don't know if they do presently in grasslands in burying the dung and getting it into, you know, absorbed into the soil. And also that historically, as I understand, the native grasses in the plains had like 12-foot deep roots and that they were able to penetrate much deeper. Does any of you want to take a comment on that?
We're talking about the difference between an annual grass versus a perennial grass. And It's funny, because I really appreciate your work, John. I'm so glad somebody... I came into this not with an agricultural background, and there have been many times when I've gone, why hasn't anybody figured this out yet? This seems to be like the most pressing issue on the planet. And so the work that John's doing, I'm amazed that Iowa State Ames hasn't done it, but I visited Fred Kirschenman there, and I said, you guys don't have a soil biology department in the birthplace of Land Grant University Agricultural Extension, and he said, we don't even have an evolutionary biology department. So science is really behind on the game. But then also, I really appreciate what you said, because we try to isolate these things. Science does, isolates and makes it simple so they can actually study something and find out. So we don't deal with complexity. And that's a lot of what Alan Savory has done. And that's why it's very easy to take pot shots at that, at the work, and say, well, it's not scientifically proven. We do see in people that manage their animals, and it's not a one-to-one. It's not a binary process. It's not just bunch the animals up. It's mimicking the large numbers of megafauna that used to be here that were managed by large numbers of predators. And it's that dynamic. And that dynamic trickles all the way down. When you have that complexity and that biodiversity above, usually it's mirrored in the soil. And so we do see things, if you don't use conventional wormers, you do see increases in dung beetles.
Can you just tell for non-agricultural listeners what a wormer is?
Well, your cattle may get parasites, and from bad management, that'll happen. And so the conventional world uses medicine for that, just like you would give a heartworm collar to your cat or dog. In the more holistic world, there are alternatives to that. Apple cider vinegar, garlic. There's a lot of folk medicine in agriculture.
And so am I hearing you right that by avoiding those medicines for which there are substitutes, or pesticides for which there are substitutes, you're allowing other members of the ecosystem to exist and play their part? Is that what you're saying in the sequestration?
Absolutely. Here's an example, and this is a little bit of a tangent, but you guys can all gang up on me. But I was working with a soil biologist, Elaine Ingham, in Africa, and I was with an agronomist in a field of onions raised on pivot irrigation. And he said, we did mycorrhizal inoculum. So they inoculated the fields with mycorrhizal fungi, very important deal. Sorry, I think that's my phone. And he said, we inoculated, we had no colonization. And we're driving around this pivot, and I look out, and there's a spray rig spraying green stuff on the field, which was very rocky soil. And then the water was going to be coming over in the pivot and irrigating from above. And I said, well, what is that you're spraying? And he said, well, it's fungicide. And I said, and so what do you dilute your fungicide with? And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, gin? And he said, no, water. I said, so you're going to put inoculum, you're going to add fungi to the soil, and then you're going to spray fungicide to kill fungi, and then you're going to put a bunch of water on that and spread it. I think you should stop buying mycorrhizal inoculum. But this is the mindset, again, that we do this because it's Thursday, and it's May, and it's that. And that's what we're doing. What we're having to do is we're having to do things differently. That's what managing these cattle or any of these ruminants in a different way is, kind of taking into account the whole system. And
I just want to remind our listeners that they're listening to a special collaboration of the Farm and Food Shed Report and Post Carbon Radio. And today we're covering climate change and agriculture. So I think, you know, one of the things you were talking about, Aaron, that I have found frustrating as well is, and we can talk a little bit about this too, what we're talking about and the kind of raising of animals and pasture management is not what the major paradigm is. And the major paradigm is where the large money is, where a lot of the funding for our ag and land grant schools comes from. So you're also dealing with, you know, there not being the funding or financial will to dig in until really recently with people like John, with your work with the Carbon Project. And I would just love for you to talk a little bit more about what roadblocks did you hit with your kind of questioning the paradigm and wanting to take the science in there.
Well, no roadblocks. We had the good fortune of having Family Foundation funding available, and that's what was different in this context. In the larger row crop and arable systems is where big ag and industry have revenues, and so that helps inform how they spend their funding in terms of support of what educational programs UC Davis or others might do. No one had looked in these grazed rangeland systems before because there's not that kind of money in it. This is a perfect application of Family Foundation funding, and that's what we've done.
And then, Nicolette, you might want to also address the fact that your first book was called Righteous Pork Chop, and you had done an investigation of basically factory farming and that kind of containment farming. So that, you know, one of the things I think that's happened in ag and that you address in your book is you can't compare apples and oranges, and you can't compare contained, you know, containment of animals with, you know, holistic ag management of animals.
Well, and also, Robin, one of the things I do in Righteous Pork Chop is just I sort of describe each sector and how it functions and what its ecological problems are. And what I learned back then, but especially as I worked on the Defending Beef book, is that agriculture is so much focused on individual production systems. And so there's very much a focus on how much is produced and what the inputs are and what the outputs are, but without considering any of the externalities. And what Aaron was talking about is really contrasting that sort of production model where you're failing to consider what all of the holistic impacts are, and contrasting that with a systems approach. And I actually had the opportunity at a Center for Ecoliteracy event a few months ago to hear the scientist Fritjof Capra speaking, and it was the first time I'd ever heard him talk. And he was talking about systems thinking and how in ecological thinking and in human medicine, we've taken this reductionistic view where we simply look at, for example, a human illness, and then we try to look at what medicine might cause it. But we don't ever step back and try to think of what were all of the various factors that led to this, and how can a person live differently to avoid these health problems? And it's really the same in food production. We try to think of, you know, pounds of pork produced or number of eggs produced. We don't look at the animal holistically and their health. We don't, and their experience. We don't look at the people in the system. We don't look at the ecological system for sure. And we certainly don't look at the way all these things interplay. So a lot of what all of, I think all of us sitting around the table are really trying to advocate for is we need to embrace the complexity of nature. And the unique thing about food production is it's really something that's practiced in nature. It should be. I mean, less and less. We're getting more and more separated from it. But if we want to come up with systems that are truly sustainable, both from a climate perspective and from all the other many ecological impacts that food production has, we really have to look at this systems approach, I think. I think that's the key.
Well, and also one of the things that had you know, been promoted so much by Big Ag was the concept of we have to feed the world and it's an emergency. And therefore, we can't, you know, be worrying about cute things like Mother Nature. People are starving to death. So I think, you know, that's an interesting thing. Like, no, we don't have to feed the world. We have to feed where we fit. And, you know, maybe if you guys could talk about that a little bit, because I think that's part of the other mindset that for the general public makes us worry and say, oh, you know, well, we have to think about people are starving. And it's actually more possibly distribution rather than production.
Well, it's a fact. I mean, we've got the data geek chick over here, so we probably rely on her, but it's a simple fact that we produce plenty of food to feed the world. The feeding the world is not a priority. So we should stop even, you know, enabling that argument.
Well, go ahead, John.
I just want to acknowledge Mark Dowie in the book he wrote called American Foundations, where he talks about where that idea came from. And he would be an interesting interview for this station regarding the Green Revolution,
right.
The family foundations that stepped up to feed the world with some pretty unfounded assumptions. And that it's our time now to challenge those assumptions.
Well yeah, and that kind of goes back to what you said. I mean, when you look at the, you know, the efforts to create the Green Revolution, it was energy. It was oil. It was tractors. When we, I manage a cow-calf to finish operation. So we raise calves, and then we finish them as grass-fed beef. We do that in a partnership right now with Pepperwood Preserve, which is a private operating foundation on the former Bechtel Ranch up in northern Sonoma County. I don't feed any hay. So Ford, International Harvester, whoever else is making a hot tractor, they're not making any revenue off of me. I don't buy any seed. My grasses improve over time. I'm foregoing the quick economic buck on the short term. It's not easy, but I'm doing that in a very planned way that is forecasting and performing to be profitable long term at the benefit of the environment, which I'm dependent on to be profitable long term. And that's just based on assumption that I don't think the economy or the oil future is a very stable thing to bet on right now with my children's future.
And I think we haven't used the word yet here today, but I think what we're really talking about is moving away from an extractive form of agriculture, and that's like a mining operation where you're treating nature as a source of resources that you can simply pull out, whether it's water, soil, fertility, to moving towards a regenerative mindset. Because it's so obvious that all of these things that the Green Revolution was founded on actually are totally finite resources, that you're not only destroying the earth when you're extracting them, but it's going to run out. So we have to come up with ways to produce food where we're actually regenerating and protecting the soils and the water. And that's actually very much exactly the kind of agriculture that those of us at the table here today are engaged in.
I would like to step in. The USDA, which is their mission is to promote soil health and subsidize agriculture, is on that track right now. This is the Healthy Soils Initiative this year. And so within that, the USDA now is promoting no tilling, keeping intact living roots in the soil, keeping the soil covered, and promoting diversity, which are kind of the mandates that we all agreed to work within. And so right now, currently, nationally, the move is towards this kind of agriculture, and Big Ag is actually embracing it. So I've been engaged with different presentations and conversations. This is our moment. We're really now turning the ship. It's very exciting what's happening.
And I just want to remind the listeners, you're listening to a special collaboration between the Farm and Food Shed Report and Post Carbon Radio. And today we're talking about agriculture and the role it plays with climate change as a mitigator and promoting practices that are a mitigator.
I would say solutions.
Yes.
I felt my my hair go up a little on the back of my neck because John is a contributor to this in a big way. But it reminds me of a thing George Seaman, who's the CEIO of Organic Valley. He said, pioneers don't like settlers very much. And it's like I see all my like, well, what a, yeah, of course Monsanto advocates no-till agriculture and whatever, but it is, it's not going to, the conventional momentum is not going to go away. So the more it can actually kind of turn to follow, you know, from a business standpoint, because I'd unwisely became an entrepreneur in this with not a lot of funding. And it's valuable, but it's really hard. You really have to make some compromising decisions up front, I think. And the thing is that I believe that there's no competition really, because the bet is on the ecosystem, on the functioning of the land. And right now with climate being the topic that it is, with water, primarily in California with water, because as much as carbon seems important, I'm not faithful that we're going to see a real carbon income as land operators. If we do, I'm going to thank you so much, and I'll owe you a beer. But water is the real one. And for every 1% increase of organic matter in our soil, we sequester another 27,000 gallons of water per acre. And if that isn't an incentive enough to treat the surface of your soil really well with smart management, I don't know what is.
Well, it's an interesting point that you bring up, and we're going to be talking about that a little more in the second hour. But, you know, when the guys that we've bucked up against become allies, you know, how we are inclusive and open, and also knowing the point at which some people will be segueing, and it might not be the sudden, you know, I've got, you know, enlightenment moment. It may take a little time. But then when you do have, you know, conventional ag, and the other people going, gosh, we really are going to run out of this stuff, you know, and actually I do care about my grandchildren, and it's an issue.
Well, I just, a couple things. First of all, I think I like what John said, that there's, you know, good positive movement within USDA and that the big ag players are on board. But I think Aaron's point that their whole business is selling, you know, fertilizers, selling chemically based soil amendments, selling seeds, selling equipment, selling fossil fuels. There's a huge amount invested in the continuation of the status quo from the big players. And I think it's going to be a long, long time before they're truly shifting their business model. From what I've seen, they're a long way from that. So I think what they're doing is they're very wisely examining, you know, all of what's happening out there and trying to make sure they have some, you know, some tentacles involved in that. And that's good. I mean, we need to have, I mean, I say to people all the time, I'm not really interested in being part of a niche market for food. I want to revolutionize the way all food is produced. And I know my husband, Bill Nyman, shares that passion. So I don't care about being a pioneer and being, you know, having other settlers come in. Although I agree with, I get your point, Aaron. But I want to have lots of settlers. I want to have everybody as settlers in this area that we're all pioneering. But there's a long way to go before we get there, as far as what mainstream agriculture is doing, because it really still is currently founded on this extractive mining type model. But that's why the pioneers are so important, because they have to show that you can not only do this but do this profitably, and then you get followers.
I need to clarify one point. When I said big ag, I wasn't talking about the corporations that provide materials and resources to land managers. I'm talking about land managers, the people actually on the ground. So the move right now... Oh, sorry, I got a note here.
Go ahead and finish. Please
anyway,
finish your comment.
The move right now is to promote healthy soils. And as a land manager, how do you do that? The very exciting news is that through our Marine Carbon Project research connecting with universities like Colorado State, where they've now taken 35 practices that the USDA knows to be soil carbon beneficial and greenhouse beneficial, we've created a carbon farm planning process. And within this new process that the USDA is promoting nationally, we can start looking at the entire landscape that's under management and identify a way to work within the boundaries, the natural boundaries of that ecosystem, where everything you do is restorative and good. And it goes way beyond compost. It includes all these other practices. And just not a, it's not a plug for me. It's a plug for Colorado State and the USDA. There's a website, if you Google COMET, C-O-M-E-T hyphen planner, that's the tool. Anyone on the world can use this tool for free right now and look at this suite of practices known to be climate beneficial, within which we can actually provide all the food, fuel, fiber, and flora that we need to support the material cultural needs for humans. And the idea here is that soon agriculture, through these kinds of informed practices, can become a solution set, unparalleled, I think.
Okay, well, we are having a very big picture conversation about the present and future of agriculture in light of climate change. This is KWMR-FM. Okay, so we were just in the middle of a very big picture discussion about where agriculture is heading and the actual farmers and land managers themselves versus corporate ag. Nicolette, I wondered if you wanted to give the sort of ABC's critique of the Green Revolution for those listeners who haven't heard that before?
Well, Aaron, I think John also alluded to the Green Revolution earlier, and that was really an approach that was being taken. I think it probably originated in the 1950s, but it was kind of blossomed in the 1960s. And it was really about trying to focus on producing yields, increasing yields, of crops, especially in developing countries where there was a lot of food shortage, or at least people weren't receiving the food. I mean, we talked earlier about this. There really has been, for a very long time, a problem actually getting systems to be fair so that people have access to food, even when there's lots of food that's being produced. In the height of the famine in the 1980s in Ethiopia, for example, they were exporting a lot of food to Europe. That seems absurd, but it's absolutely true. And that's probably true of a lot of the world's famines. So it not necessarily was never maybe the right question to be asked, but this question of how do we increase food production has been on the table for a long time, and especially at that time in history, and mostly through the use of fossil fuel-based chemicals and machinery and different seed technologies, the yields were increased pretty dramatically for lots of the staple crops, rice and grain and so forth. And so it was viewed, it has been hailed as a great success, the world over many times, because so much more food was produced as a result. The problem is it was really this kind of short-term thinking in terms of both, the source of the fertility and in terms of the impact of the shift in the way practices were changed, things that resulted in probably really... an injury to water resources, a loss of soils, a loss of soil biology, which a lot of what we've been talking about today is the importance of soil biology. And interestingly, that whole question of the life of the soil, what's actually happening on especially a microscopic level, has been was almost ignored in science until just the last decade or so, and is now being viewed as almost the key to the most important aspect of food production. So that's kind of the legacy of the Green Revolution. And I think there are many people in the sort of current sustainable agriculture movement that would look at the Green Revolution as at best a mixed success. And some would probably argue a colossal misdirection of agriculture. And so you'll hear very mixed reviews and comments of that whole effort.
Anyone else want to weigh in on that before we take a move? Oh, we're giving a new guest in the studio. We're really having a party here today.
So I just wanted to reflect on the legacy of the Green Revolution and what perhaps the political drivers were behind it also, which are currently not something that we regard as being important anymore. So the root of the Green Revolution was a political one. And again, I would encourage you to read Mark Dowie's book. And so those issues are gone, yet we're still chasing this thing.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that, Nicolette, that you and I have talked about, too, that in terms of, you know, even those of us that are promoting regenerative and restorative agriculture, and sometimes in our own ways, we can get narrow-minded, too. So the whole thing of local, local, local. But there's certain areas of the country that are really, really made to have, you know, grazing animals and livestock. And certain areas of the country, perhaps like the Southeast, which is far better for row crops because of the amount of rain they get. So we also have to ourselves think in terms of a bigger picture and of, you know, what's happening.
Well, I'm definitely a believer in both of my books. I talk about the fact that I think that the local issue is kind of misused. I think there are many benefits to food systems being more local and more regional, and especially for certain types of food products. But when you're talking about things like the meat from grazing animals, it really doesn't make a lot of sense, because when you look at the globe, there's somewhere between 30% to 40% that is naturally meant, that is in fact grasslands right now. And those are areas that if you have well-managed animals, they will actually benefit from the presence of those animals, and those really should be grazed, both to maintain the grasslands and to produce food in a healthful way. But there are other areas where grazing animals really don't make any sense, because there isn't enough available land. You're going to have them, you know, stabled or fed a lot of stored feeds for large portions of the year, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the idea that all food production should be local and that that's the solution, whether to climate change or anything else, is not sound.
And one of the other issues around that is, as people are starting to learn from the work that all of you've done, is that especially meats are seasonal, you know, and there are certain times of year that are better for them to be harvested. So we also have to learn to get used to the concept of, once again, wise food preservation, freezing, being comfortable with buying things within season and freezing it. And then we've just had Albert Strauss join us, who is the founder of Strauss Family Creamery, the first organic dairy west of the Mississippi, and also an amazing work that he's doing called Mindful Milk in India, helping farmers there to do better practices based on his own experience. And so also looking at ways that in our own area, ways to do things like milk, where you preserve them as cheeses and yogurts. And so it's also having to reconnect us as the consumer to how we purchase, what we purchase, seasonality, those kinds of things as well. So, Albert, you might want to just speak a little bit, because we've been talking about grazing and grazing in grasslands and pastures, because dairy is different than meat, you know, ranching for raising meat. So there are some different pressures in terms of what you're seeing that you're doing and how climate change, especially the drought, has impacted the dairies.
Well, thank you for inviting me to come on the show. Yeah, there's many practices that we've done in organic agriculture that actually integrate pastures, rotational pastures, minimizing supplemental feeds. The drought has had a huge impact on the amount of pastures we have, as well as the cost and the quantity and quality of the feeds that we can purchase from California, Nevada, Oregon. So I think we've made huge progress in Marin County, Sonoma County. We just had the livestock and crop report come out that shows 86% of dairies in Marin County are certified organic. So conventional is no longer, this is now the niche.
here.
And for the first time in 60 years, we're increasing the number of dairies in Marin County. If we went from 25 to 29. So we've reversed a trend that has been on a downhill path for decades.
And one of the things, and John can jump in on this too, like knowing what your region does and what West Marin and West Sonoma do so beautifully is raise pasture, raise grasses. And that's why we should be a great dairy region. And I know John's talked some about grasses.
Yeah,
you might want to chime
in. I just wanted to segue into Albert's good work. And the transition from conventional dairy to organic requires a certain amount of access to pasture. Could you comment on that and why that's successful here?
Well, the national organic regulations require, require 120 days and 30% of dry matter, which comes out to most of your nutrition comes from pasture for those 120 days. This year, we barely made that. But what we've done, our dairy is part of the Marine Carbon Project, and we've been working on many practices over the decades, but intensive rotational grazing, we're adding more compost, we're looking at windbreaks and hedgerows. The model that we've come, the 20-year plan that we've come up with for our farm, 1,600 of the 2,000 metric tons that we use sequestering a year comes from our methane digester. So there's a lot to be said by just capturing methane and using it for energy and for other purposes. Then also the practices on the land really help do those same kind of things.
Yeah, and just back on that theme of, you know, certain regions are good for certain things. I'm a big fan of Savannah, and so diversified. The regenerative movement is fueled partially by the whole permaculture crowd. So the potential for us to start planting some trees, I wouldn't mind if there were a few more trees in my pastures, because shade right now, you've got this coastal happiness here. It's pretty cool for most of the year, but up in the top of the Mayacamas Mountains, it gets hot. It would be nice to have that shade.
Well, we have nice spring winds, and that dries out everything in about a couple weeks. So it's cooler, but it gets a lot of wind.
Oh, yeah.
The one thing that I heard a comment before was that conventional agriculture said we need to feed the world, and I've heard that story for decades. But what I'm seeing is that we need to help farmers in the local regions around the world have better practices and get communication, get information and communication about what practices are, how to, we've been able to work with subsistence farmers in India. Dr. Vedana Shiva asked me to come to India, and I went there about 2 years ago to help the subsistence dairy farmers get more to organic practices and to work on the quality of milk, which I've discovered was worst case 3 to 5 hours, best case 3 to 5 days of shelf life. We've been able to work with a man in India who's been working with these farms. We've been able to double their milk production, eliminate antibiotics, which was very prevalent. And we're working on a plan. We've actually worked and made progress on getting at least 14 days of shelf life. Everybody boils their milk in India because it's such bad quality, and they need to be able to preserve it. So I think just in that instance, there are ways. India has more cows than the United States has. Mm-hmm. You know, when I came back from India, they were saying the biggest market for United States dairymen is to export to India. I'm going, what are you talking about? This is happening all over the world. How can we help farmers and communities around the world revitalize their farming community and supply their own people food?
And one of the issues that, and I know Nicolette addresses in her book, there had first been the one study, I can't remember, that cast such a long shadow on raising, you know, cattle and grazing animals. And then the second one that came out, I think, 2 years ago from the UN about what would feed the world, quote unquote, was the widespread use or the widespread presence of subsistence farming. and that, you know, and having every area know what's the best way to do it. It's not about one giant, you know, factory spewing out the food for the world.
Well, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations produced a report in 2006 called "The Livestock's Long Shadow," and the lead researcher on that actually has visited our ranch, and I've had an opportunity to talk with him there and also in Germany when I met him. He's a German guy, actually. And so I've read the report. I've talked with the lead researcher on it. I've looked at it a lot, and there's a lot of. It's a very credible report. I mean, to me, it's far better than the vast majority of the stuff that's been produced on this issue. But what's interesting is you realize when you really look at the report and you talk to the lead researcher that the thesis of that report was essentially that we need to move towards more intensification in agriculture. We need to have fewer animals grazing the land, and we need to have more animals in large confinement operations, and especially pork and poultry. So that's really the thrust of that report. And so it's sort of ironic to me that it's constantly used by people that are against intensification and against agriculture or livestock production in general. The Food and Agriculture Organization, the same branch of the United Nations, came out with a report. They produce reports all the time. And they have put out a number of very good reports talking about the importance of smaller scale farming, of diversification, of organic practices. They've put out, in fact, I've had a number of conversations with people who are part of the FAO. And they've told me that there was a lot of unhappiness when the Livestock's Long Shadow report came out, because it really didn't represent the view of a lot of the people there, because it was so negative towards grazing animals. And there have been a number of reports that have contradicted a lot of aspects of that. But the Food and Agriculture Organization itself also produced a report in 2013 that specifically updated the Livestock's Long Shadow report and reduced the total number that they estimated all livestock contributes to global warming or to climate change. And they reduced the number from 18% to 14%, which is a fairly significant difference. So I think that's probably the most credible estimate for all animals in terms of their contribution. But the question to me is not do we then get rid of the animals? Is that an inherent part of animal production? And I think there's a very good body of evidence showing that it's not inherently part of livestock production. There's probably always going to be some impact, just as there will be from flying in an airplane or driving a car. But I think the majority of that number comes from bad management practices and industrialization. And so if we look at sustainable food production, to me, the answer is never to get rid of animals. It's really to figure out what role animals should be playing in the food system. And the more I've looked at the question, I started working on these issues in 2000, so it's been about 15 years, just sort of researching this and visiting places around the world. And increasingly, I'm convinced animals are actually an essential part of a sustainable food system, because they add so much that can't be added to a food system in any other way. And they add that complexity that mimics nature most of all. And I think that's absolutely essential.
Well, it's really interesting. I know that we're going to have James Stark joining us in the second hour, and we'll talk some about, like, in the regenerative design and permaculture issues. You know, you have to have the whole system together. But I know that I just want to remind the listeners that are listening to a collaboration between Post Carbon Radio and the Farm and Food Shed Report, and we're talking about climate change and agriculture as a solution to what's going on. John, I know you had something to say.
Well, yeah, I wanted to focus on the long shadow of livestock. The issue was methane production. And so something I heard, which I haven't been able to find support for, but it was very compelling, was that historically the population of deer in America was about 30 million. And over the last 200 years, it's now expanded to over 300 million. So there's a source of methane that's going completely unaccounted for in these natural systems. And if you look at the national herd of beef, I believe it's less than the national herd of bison were historically in the system as well. So I think it's important to take a larger view and look at overall balance and flows of these things, and without focusing too much on one source. That we can measure the methane from captive animals, but the wild heard. Who knows, right? We could calculate that.
Well, it's interesting just to quickly bring up, and Aaron's talked about this before, apex predators. When you don't have the apex predators out there that we did have, then the explosion with the deer population, you know, so that it is about a whole system and we're missing some pieces there.
I do want to comment on apex predators. You can't just drop Mexican wolves in a Yellowstone park.
No one's suggesting that. But the lack of predation in the system, and it's the predation pressure that's most critical. And that's the thing that we're doing with electric fencing. And I don't have to tell you that. But basically the some proxy of predation is absolutely required to manage these prey.
So, Aaron, you're saying we need to drop you in more places.
No, I'm tired enough. But there's a bunch of folks that are you know, into learning this, but absolutely. And technology is going to come around to make it much easier to manage in these ways, for sure.
My point was that it is more of an art than we may acknowledge. And my understanding is that the native population of wolves in Yellowstone were much smaller animals and behaved differently as a pack than the ones that they've introduced, which are much, much larger and are able to take down bigger animals and things like that. So reintroducing a predator it has to be much more fully thought through than just a proxy.
Yeah, actually, I think, I'm not that studied on this, but I've been pretty obsessed about the entire collapse of the Pleistocene and how that seemed to be the most recent stable, you know, albeit chaotic, but stable ecological period on the planet for close to 2.5 million years. And it had a massive shift in the bandwidth about 10,000 years when we came in and started agriculture. I think that the system has degraded so far, there's no way we can rewild this. It's so dismantled. The only way for us to get back there is for us to accept the role that we have, which is we are apex predator and quite likely keystone species right now on the planet. And we have this phenomenal responsibility and obligation if we want to survive as a species. And I don't want to get, you know, overly serious about this, but that is ultimately the planet can't support certain types of life. That's what extinction is. And so we're on that track, whether it's 100,000 years from now or a million years from now. But if we keep doing what we're doing and we don't come up with an alternative, it's an inevitability on a finite system. So and it's not that finite. That's what we're finding out. So if we're smart enough about becoming a willing component of our ecosystem rather than the perceptual driver of it, we might be able to improvise our way through learning from all of these things to a place where we'll actually turn that clock and start a regenerative system.
So I would want to point out that we do not have that kind of time frame. In a recent event, a representative from the USDA said, we will be the last generation who can change this. Our children won't have the tools and opportunity. This is our lifetime. We have to turn this extinction around. It's happening now.
That's why I move cattle at 52. Anybody want to come out and set fencing with me? Let's go.
I think everyone probably agrees on the urgency of it, but I think what Aaron's point was, and I really agree with this, is that there's no one answer right now, and that there are a lot of people trying different approaches, and that we're going to have to keep innovating and keep experimenting, and it's going to be a lot of little pieces that are going to come together to offer really meaningful solutions to this. I don't think there is any one answer.
No, I would suggest those are a process, though, and this is what the team of scientists I'm working with are looking at now. What is working with global circulation models at a global scale? What are the land management systems and what natural systems can we combine with new information to determine whether or not we can have the impact that we want to have? And that's what we're looking at with a team at Lawrence Berkeley Lab now. I'm very excited about that project.
Yeah, we definitely have a toolkit right now. We can't say we don't have tools to use immediately that are effective.
Well, I think that also if we look at agriculture in this country, we're the ones that are using GMOs, using it to spray herbicides on I mean, 90% of, over 90% of GMOs are made to, so they can spray Roundup. So, or pesticide.
Right.
So
that's the primary.
And those are depleting soils. Those practices are depleting soils. And I think we have an alternative of agriculture that can sustain and build soil and produce good food and be healthy for animals, people, and more of a sustainable system. So I think that there are things we can address now that are being spotlighted in the nation. You know, I think organic agriculture, which they think is a niche, is now not a niche. Conventional agriculture for the last 60, 70 years has not worked. We had 4.6 million dairy farms in 1940. We have now 45,000 left. So, and producing more products and more milk, but it's not sustainable. And it's not sustainable for communities, farming communities, for rural communities. So we need to make those changes.
And Albert's been, just to let our listeners know, that Albert has been a staunch advocate for stopping the proliferation and the untested, just not wise release of GMOs and the, you know, expanded use of glyphosate across America, which we've now got countries like Russia saying, we're not going to do that to our water supply, to our grounds, to our soil. You know, when we're seeing, I mean, so that's heartening to hear what John's saying about the USDA starting to get on board around soil, because we know now that glyphosate is sterilizing the soil. So, you know, becoming aware of those kinds of things.
Yeah, and it's important to point out, it's not glyphosate, it's Roundup. It's a different product. It's a different.
Isn't glyphosate the actual
active ingredient?
Active ingredient, yeah. but there's a lot of data on glyphosate that shows it as relatively inert that Roundup does not come with.
Yeah, Roundup. Disagree with that.
But in addition, doesn't Roundup contain surfactants and other things that that are not being looked at?
Right,
but there are recent studies that Albert can address more than I can on glyphosate in the past 18 months.
Yeah. Doctors Seralini and Antonio out of UK and France have been doing studies on glyphosate and causing cancers and the correlations of cancers in people, and glyphosate being prevalent in our environment in the United States,
okay,
much more than the rest of the world.
Okay. Yeah.
And also with Dr. Don Huber, who had been on Homeland Security and with the USDA, and several USDA scientists who actually retired over the issue because their own studies from the land-grant universities they worked at were proving that glyphosate was causing abdominal abnormalities and sterilization. And Dr. Huber believed that it was actually a Homeland Security issue, that we could collapse our livestock food supply, basically, if we did not stop the overuse.
But my point just on the surfactants was glyphosate's bad enough, but then when you compound it with other chemicals that nobody's even looking at, then it's even more out of control. That was my point.
Good. Mine too.
Okay, we're going to have to take a break now and let listeners know this is KWMR, 90.5 Point Reyes Station, 89.9 Bolinas, and 92.3 in San Geronimo Valley.
So you've been listening to a special collaboration between the Farm and Food Shed Report and Post Carbon Radio. We're ending up our first hour. We're going to take a little music break, and we'll be back with some additional guests. So stay tuned for the special collaboration of agriculture and climate change and how agriculture brings solutions and regeneration.
Welcome back to KWMR special, a two-hour special, a collaboration between the Farm and Food Shed Report and Post Carbon Radio with co-hosts Robin Carpenter, Karen Nyhus, and Bing Gong. We're taking a deeper look at how agriculture impacts climate change. How can agriculture diminish or mitigate and adapt to climate change and be part of the solution? The first hour, we were talking about busting myths, the grazing animals, compost, and soil carbon sequestration. The second hour, we're going to be oriented more towards practical aspects of creating change and implementing better agriculture in the face of industrial agriculture, factory farm, the paradigm. And in the studio, we have John Wick of the Marin Carbon Project and Albert Strauss of Strauss Family Creamery. And on the line, James Stark, co-founder of the Regenerative Design Institute, who will be talking about permaculture in relation to climate change, and Evan Wigg with the Farmers Guild. Welcome, James and Evan.
Hi. Great. Thank you so much for having me on.
Wonderful. Evan, could you tell us a little bit about the Farmers Guild?
Yeah, sure. So the Farmers Guild is an organization. It's a network of coalitions around California that are made up primarily of new and young farmers, but we welcome and accept and encourage farmers of every generation who get together on a monthly basis, talk shop, share information, and get the resources they need to be truly sustainable farmers, which means sustainable both in terms of ecological terms as well as sustainable from an entrepreneurial in perspective. So we do a lot of programs, a lot of events, both for the public as well as more specifically for aspiring and growing agricultural entrepreneurs of every kind, from livestock down to little market gardens. And we've got three chapters here in Sonoma County, a couple up in Mendo, Humboldt, Yolo County, and San Luis Obispo.
Thank you, Evan. James, tell us a little bit about Regenerative Design Institute.
Well, we, and I'm filling in for Penny, who would probably be on the show, but she's in Bali working with Balinese farmers. And so we offer, the main thing that we're offering is programs through permaculture to have people come in off the street who are curious about how they can transform their lives and get more in touch with the food they're eating and how they're living and their lifestyle and all of that put together. And so in some ways in this conversation, it's exploring the role that the homeowner can play in this whole equation and creating the awareness there through them taking on part of the role of feeding themselves and supporting ag. And I think that permaculture, for the most part, where it's had its greatest impact has been in other countries, in Africa and in Asia, where people are really against the wire. They're at starvation level and hunger levels, and that's where the bulk of the work has been in the past. And how do you take that bare ground where there isn't one thing to eat on it and transform that desert situation and create abundance? In the North American and the Western context, it's how to increase the possibility that people who are buying pieces of land, what they could do with that land to bring the water back in and then look at how to create food in that system. And I think, you know, our work has been to support how to support the movement of regenerative agriculture and by creating customers, but also creating now, we've over the last 10 years and longer than that, 20, some of the students who've come through our program are now leading, like up in Sebastopol with Eric Olson, creating the new farm school, which just got launched last week. So, you know, we've been seeding the next generation of activists to move into that. So that's been our main role. And plus, looking at the inner garden aspect, like the consciousness and what has to shift on the level of consciousness, not only for the farmers but for the consumers as well. What's that shift of relationship to the natural world and awareness and all that? So that's kind of what we've been up to.
Well, I know that one of the things we wanted to talk about, this is Robin, during the second part of the show, is, and what you're talking about too, James, is practical application across the board. What can particular homeowners do? What can we do in our own sphere of influence to help raise our own food and have a a level of consciousness that makes us support the people raising food and treating the land appropriately. Evan, you're helping young people come into it. You know, John, you've been helping bring the science to the table. And Albert, you know, one thing that's heartening is you started Strauss Family Creamery in 1984.
Was 94.
It 94. And, you know, so it hasn't been that long, but yet it's flipped Marin Dairy. I mean, you were the visionary that saw that organic, that not only did it work, it was what was healthier, what people wanted. And so you, in a practical sense, I mean, you've saved the dairies that are third and fourth generation dairies out here, many of them, and have joined on board with Strauss Family Dairies. So the work that you've done is not niche, as you said, anymore. It is what the norm is now here. If you could maybe address a little bit about what that entails to make our visions and our higher level of consciousness real in the real world.
Let me jump in here. I think Albert's success is based on the fact that what he produces is delicious.
Thank you.
Well,
that speaks to you right there.
Thank you, John. Our mission as a business and a creamery is to sustain family farms in Marin Sonoma County, organic dairy farms in Marin Sonoma County, and help revitalize the farming community by producing high-quality, minimally processed organic products. And we are also trying to create a model and educate the public about practices and the agriculture community at large.
I would like you to jump in on that.
I had the great good fortune in an earlier version of my life where we were part of a milk co-op where one of our community members, and myself included, would drive out to the Strauss Dairy and pick up our baskets of ice cream and milk. And my point actually was pretty serious. I think from my grazing management, I understand the relationship between how things taste, the nutrient quality, and that's the best pathway to integrate the things that James and I've forgotten the name of the other gentleman on the phone, but
Evan.
So connecting all of that in terms of connecting consumers, producers, communities, I think Albert actually embodies all of that quite successfully because he delivers products and provides products to communities. There's a relationship directly between Albert, his dairy, and consumers, and that informs the whole community and gets everyone excited.
Well, I think that what we're trying to do is create a model. I do a lot of different practices at our dairy and our creamery to see what practices will work in a sustainable way. I mean, at the dairy, we've a methane digester. We've done organic practices. We did no-till planting beginning in the early 80s. There's a lot of different practices we're doing that farmers wouldn't do because they're not necessarily economically, you know, they'll bring a return quickly. At the creamery, we're reusing as much water. I had to go all the way to the state government to get approval to put in a reuse system for water. It's going to save us at least 5,000 gallons a day of water, which wasn't specifically mentioned in the code, but I had to go to the Secretary of Agriculture to see how we could get it allowed because it made sense. There was a 25% mandate to reduce water, and I've got all these practices I want to do. We also are looking at a waste treatment system at the creamery that would produce energy as well as take 75% of the water back to potable. So we're looking at big changes that can really affect how agriculture is sustainable and how it can be an important part of our community.
We just wanted to remind the listeners, you're listening to a special edition of Post Carbon Radio and the Farm and Food Shed Report talking about agriculture and the solutions it can bring to the issues and challenges of climate change.
John, I wanted to ask you a question about the Marin Carbon Project. You were talking about doing the research since 2007, and now you're going into implementation. Can you tell us how that's working out and where?
Well, I would talk to Albert. He's one of the primary demonstration sites, and on Albert's property now, we're looking at a suite of practices. He's been collaborating with the local resource conservation district and Nancy Scolari's team. Sorry, here we're getting a mic adjustment. And the NRCS and the whole team at the Marine Carbon Project. And the idea here is that we establish something scientifically. What was important to then determine was, does this work in the real world? So we were able to then invite in applicants, and Albert was selected out of quite a few who applied. There are two other ones as well, the Stemple Creek in Tamales and the Corda Dairy. And on those sites, we've now been able to take our practices to scale and expand the practice list to include what I talked about earlier, the 35 practices that we're considering carbon farms made out of. So that's one track, and it's very successful. And we're looking at on-the-ground implementation of the research. Concurrently, we're just starting now another phase of research on the Lafranchi Dairy with the West Marine Compost Project. And there, Dr. Silver and her team are organizing to look at the greenhouse gas emissions from the compost processes. This is a very important research project. We're going to get at the first principles of composting. And what's exciting to me is by collaborating with CalRecycle, which is the state agency that regulates and oversees compost creation and compost projects statewide, we'll now inform how compost is produced statewide to have minimum greenhouse gas emissions, the least amount of VOCs, and the maximum soil carbon sequestration. Concurrent with that, we're also working with Lawrence Berkeley National Lab on another phase of our research in human waste composting, and this time we're looking at pharmaceuticals. And we've already been able to put ibuprofen and Cipro in compost piles, and working with a team at Lawrence Berkeley Lab who have a specially tuned mass spectrometer, we're able to now detect signal, and we'll be able to follow degradation of those products in the compost environment. That's really exciting as well.
John, one of the things that you taught me about compost that I didn't realize is how it helps create beneficials, but it also does help purify for things that we have a huge issue with now, like pharmaceuticals. Could you just describe to the listeners a little bit of how that works? Because it almost sounds like wizardry and alchemy all mixed together. It's so amazing what it does.
It's much more simple than wizardry and magic. Any organic thing, this could be food waste or biomass, branches, brush, all of the organic materials have the opportunity to have one of several processes occur to them. It could be mummified, which is when you bury it in a landfill, which causes greenhouse gas emissions. It can rot, which is what leaving the vegetative material on the soil does, which also releases greenhouse gases. Or it could be composted, which is the intentional management of those materials by combining air, moisture, carbon, and nitrogen to create the ideal environment within which thermophilic bacteria will dominate the pile. And in doing so, they achieve tremendous heat. And that's heat. That heat is what got us very excited, because in my preliminary research on my ranch with the scientists, we achieved 171 degrees Fahrenheit within a week by combining the ingredients. That high temperature suggested that we could then look at that process to destroy pathogens. CalRecycle is the state agency that oversees compost production, and their specification of 131 degrees assures us that we will destroy weed seed viability and common pathogens from the human temperature range, from our gut bacteria. But by going higher than that, our thought was perhaps we could also destroy or deactivate much more interesting things like pharmaceuticals. So our phase one, we did destroy pathogens quite clearly and with certainty. We're now looking at pharmaceuticals. Next, we'll look at deactivating compounds of emerging concern and hormones. This will ultimately expand our ability to compost anything that was ever alive. And then we have a whole other decision. What's the highest, first, and best use of those feedstocks? Should it go from food to fuel? Should it go from food to food? Should it be fed to animals, chickens and pigs? Should it be composted? These are all the next tier of questions that we'll be organizing to answer.
John, there was another exciting part was when NASA came out to our farm to look at how to image carbon, right?
Yeah, so in our so this is very important. When we first saw the data from our initial research, we were able to observe that putting a half inch of compost on test plots with controls right next to them where we didn't put compost, we saw amazing results. It was very exciting. We did not put any more compost out. That half inch application the next year caused another ton of carbon to come in photosynthetically into a durable form in the system. Very exciting. That continued. We've measured 5 years now of ongoing atmospheric carbon transformation photosynthetically into durable soil carbon. Dr. Bill Parton at Colorado State University took our data set and ran it through the Century model. During that exercise, he showed that that process, that phenomenon of this ongoing flow of carbon from the atmosphere, will continue from 30 to 100 years from that single half-inch application. This is the most exciting news on the planet that I can tell you. He also suggested that a quarter inch would work. So when we went out onto Albert's Ranch and Stemple Creek Ranch, we were able to put in large-sized exclusions and split the plots, quarter-inch and half-inch applications. And by doing that, Dr. Chris Potter with NASA is able now to watch remotely from satellite imagery the biomass response. He uses the NDVI spectrum, and he determined just within 4 months that we saw the same kind of greening up. And that showed us that the quarter-inch also did the same thing the half-inch did. Very exciting. And that, of course, I've learned to say, requires further research, which is what we're doing now.
I know, James, that permaculture really works very closely with and teaching those of us who maybe have enough land to grow some of our food with that whole process of the recycling and the regeneration and the compost. Could you talk a little bit about that on the, say, the home gardener or small landowner scale?
Well, and it's interesting that we're dealing with climate change and then how what is the front yard and the backyard got to do with that and what's possible. We've got a small aquaponic system here that we're operating in the classroom and looking at that, you know, so people could actually raise fish in their backyard in suburbia if they wish to do that. And the transformation of thinking, giving land a rest where land isn't completely appropriate for providing food and nutrient, and the emerging cricket farming business that's starting to arise, you know, where the math is coming in now, the crunching of the numbers, like how much goes into creating a pellet to feed a chicken, and soybean doesn't come up as being very competitive to creating a pound of cricket. So it's I find it really exciting because it's at the stage where we're reinventing agriculture on one level and generating food. But another level, it's taking the old practices that made sense and how do we work on that level. But with the homeowners and how they can use that precious ground that they're around to be able to get some of their basic needs provided within 20 feet of their house and between the neighbors. And that's the practices that the people who are in a year-long program with us begin to explore, that they just aren't out there in isolation, like, which is the culture of suburbia, that they begin to realize, oh, I can be in relationship with that person, and we start doing things together. And it starts to affect the basic consciousness, because everything that's being discussed is how do we transform these larger systems, but the other dimension of it is how do we transform the relationship that people have to their bodies. And I just came back from a two-week cleanse that I've done for the last 13 years, and I was confronted with 56 people who are off the street, lawyers, doctors, like the whole range. And there they are with quite a unique way of looking after their bodies, and they're now in chronic situations. So I'm really interested in how we have regenerative healthcare systems and how they twin with regenerative agricultural practices so that we create the demand from people who now have an awareness that it makes a difference if you buy a bottle of Strauss milk compared to the other options. And so I think that's what I have curiosity about, like how does that consciousness shift happen away from the manufactured food so that they become the strong advocates to to bring the more finances and demand into to promoting these regenerative practices.
So you just heard Evan Wigg, the executive director.
That's James Stark.
Stark, co-director of the Regenerative Design Institute in Bolinas at Commonweal. On the phone, we also have Evan Wigg, the executive director of the Farmers Guild. And in the studio with us, we have Albert Strauss, the founder of the Strauss Family Creamery, and John Wick, one of the founders of the Marin Carbon Project. I just want to encourage our listeners to stay tuned, because toward the end of the hour, we are going to do the climate calendar, which we've started doing on post-carbon, and it will include some information on a rain barrel workshop opportunity. So the front yard, backyard that you're talking about, we've got a little bit of information. And with that, I want to hand it back to Bing and Robin.
Yeah, I want to invite Evan to weigh in.
Yeah, and Evan, I was just going to say, you've talked a lot about the new younger farmers coming in. How are they approaching, and how are they able to economically show up and adopt these new practices and move forward? Because a lot of them are coming forward because of their own consciousness about our food supply.
That's very, very true. So a lot of the folks who show up to the Farmers Guild, whether at our events, our monthly meetings, or any of our programming, a lot of them are first-generation farmers. They're not coming to agriculture because that's what their father did and that's what his father did. They're not coming to agriculture because that's what was expected of them. They're doing it because of what they've learned through books and classes and seeing the food system become what it is today, which we've heard a lot about over the last hour and a half. One of the big challenges that we're up against right now, I think, as far as climate change and just the ecological impact of agriculture, is being able to weigh the economic realities of agriculture as a sustainable business model with the ideals that we've set up. Albert Strauss is a fantastic example of someone who's been able to successfully marry those two concepts, both a deeper ecological understanding of our natural resources, as well as a model that not only provides him a living, but also a living for a number of family farms around the North Bay. However, a lot of the folks, these young folks who show up to the Guild, they come to our meetings with a lot of these very, very idealistic conceptions of how the world should be, and honestly, they're entirely valid in having those conceptions. On hearing a lot of these demonstration farms, a lot of experimental grazing practices, about these regenerative practices, and then they get into agriculture and realize that with skyrocketing land prices, with an incredibly competitive market, with incredibly low prices for food coming from commodity markets, that in order to actually sustain themselves and their own lives, it's incredibly challenging simply to start a business and maintain their standards of what they believe agriculture should be. So what we end up seeing a lot is simply a huge barrier. And right now in the agricultural system, we have a lot of hidden costs that aren't necessarily always accounted for. So when you have, for instance, two businesses, and luckily we have labels like organic that are able to distinguish, but when you have, for instance, two businesses operating simultaneously, but one is doing using a practice that is more beneficial, say, for instance, and reduces greenhouse gases and sequesters carbon and all of that, sometimes that comes out in the quality of the product, as in, I'm sure anyone who has tasted Strauss milk knows that there's a huge difference in taste. It may even come out in yield and productivity long-term of the land. But when you're just starting out and you are going in debt to lease land at incredibly high prices, and then you go to the market and you have spent time and effort and resources on putting in bee corridors and hedgerows and establishing the upfront investment to do no-till farming, for instance, things like that, it's a huge challenge. And what it really one of the big elements is that it comes down to is consumer education, because some of these practices can be explained to your CSA members. Some of these practices can be explained maybe at the natural food store, perhaps through some creative labeling. But ultimately, when it comes down to what farms are going to be able to provide our schools, what farms are going to be able to provide larger food businesses, what farms are going to be able to provide for hospitals. Unfortunately, at least here in North Bay, a lot of these small, incredibly innovative, incredibly forward-thinking, ecologically-minded farms simply can't meet demand. And as of right now, we have a few of our last remaining mid-sized farms going out of business, and it's really unfortunate. So the small-scale, you know, market gardens are awesome, and we need more of them, and I encourage anyone who can grow food on whatever scale they can to do so. But how are we going to make a transition from getting young folks who are primarily graduating with tens of thousands of dollars of student debt into agricultural entrepreneurs who can provide ecologically friendly food for larger groups, say, for instance, like your child's school?
Great. So you've just been hearing from Evan Wigg, the executive director of the Farmers Guild, bringing us some of the challenges that the current generation of upcoming farmers and farmer wannabes are facing as they try to not only do the right thing in community agriculture, but also make it climate sustainable, which is the topic of our show today. So we're just going to take a moment to let you know this is KWMR-FM, and KWMR is supported by the Bear Valley Inn, a turn-of-the-century bed and breakfast, a green business serving local and organic ingredients in continental breakfast. Rates and availability are at 415-663-1777 or online at bearvinn.com. That's bear, like the animal, V as in Victor, INN.com.
So, I mean, Albert, you're kind of, maybe you can address that a little bit yourself, because the work you're doing in India, the work you've done here, you've really focused on it must be practical, it must be workable, but we have a high standard.
Well, I think that it's been a huge challenge. We've been trying to hold meetings and work with different groups in the community over the challenges of land. How can a next generation or new farmer afford to get land? How can where's the housing coming from with our communities? All the housing is for vacation rentals, or it's not people actually living and working in the community. And where are they going to get the resources to be able to do this? So, Evan, we're trying to work with Malt, we're trying to work with Marin Organic, we're trying to work with Evans Group, and UC Extension and all these different organizations that help farmers to kind of think innovatively about how can we make it so that the next generation can get the land, housing, and resources to be able to make a viable operation.
I would like to step in there. I think that what we're struggling with is what society puts importance on. And that's the challenge. How do we do aspirational policy, for instance, that supports agriculture? The Farm Bill is an amazing structure, and it's over time achieved a certain outcome. Maybe it's time to revisit the Farm Bill and actually redeploy it for what it was originally intended for, which is promoting soil health and subsidizing food production, food and fiber production.
And John, just in case people don't know, who's benefiting from the Farm Bill mainly now?
Well, most of the Farm Bill funding goes to the SNAP program. And one of the things I heard recently was, which, instead of food stamps, the idea to connect the people who need to eat the food with CSAs and local farmers. So that would be a very interesting exploration to get Farm Bill funding available for people to buy food with it from farmers.
Do you know whether anyone's working on that?
Yes, and that does already exist. There's a lot of folks who are working on doing that. There's a lot of market match programs that allow for EBT users to be able to trade in, and not only trade in, but get doubled on their dollar, to be able to use SNAP dollars for food at local farmers market. There was also a program last year that sought to bring EBT machines to onto farms free of charge. They gave the EBT machines free to farmers. And that was a fantastic, and the market program has actually been hugely successful. There's a lot of groups. Petaluma Bounty is one that's working really hard right now to get that to further that and get it more institutionalized. But it has proven to be a huge opportunity. The fact that our government dollars are going into providing for low-income families while also supporting our small-scale family farmers. Direct-to-market farmers at the same time, I think, is great, and any possibility we can get to push that forward. There's a lot of bills right now that are pushing that forward. As far as the EBT machine on the CSAs, unfortunately, it may have just been the wrong time. Maybe it wasn't ready, but a lot of those didn't pan out quite as well as people were hoping. One of the problems with any of these issues in the food system is that it's not always as simple as we like to think. If we give EBT machines to farmers, then anyone can join their CSA. That doesn't necessarily take into consideration that low-income communities often have busy schedules. People are working two or three jobs. A lot of the farms are out in the rural areas. For us to expect low-income communities to go take time out of their day to drive out to West Marin County or say the Sebastopol area to pick up the CSA and then have the education to be able to use the vegetables, the time to be able to cook it. Unfortunately, there's a lot of systemic barriers to that. I still encourage any farmers to adopt the program and get an EBT machine onto your farm, but I think that there's going to be a lot of bigger issues to work through first before that really becomes a viable option.
What is a EBT machine?
EBT. EBT. So it's the ability for recipients of what was formerly called food stamps to use food stamp dollars at a CSA.
So it's actually a device that lets them scan something for purchases?
Yep. So we had one at our farm. There was one even at Singing Frogs Farm out in Sebastopol, and they were really great proponents of the program. A lot of publicity went out to get people to join the CSA, and I think in the end, I think they got one subscriber who didn't stick with the program very long. I think Laguna Farm, also in Sebastopol, had a little more success with it. But yeah, there are a lot of programs out there working towards bringing some of these state as well as federal fundings into ways that are going to really improve our food system. Another one I'd like to list while we're talking, which is actually going to be coming up here on Wednesday, will actually be going on to onto the a committee to be voted on, is SB 367, which is the Agriculture Climate Benefits Act. It was introduced to a statewide competitive grant program to fund demonstration projects that employ climate-friendly practices by farmers and ranchers that reduce greenhouse gas emissions or store carbon. They're talking about investing $25 million of the state's cap and trade revenue into these new programs. So if anyone here is listening and they want to get more information on that, CalCan is the organization that's been doing a lot of work to push forward this proposal. So you check it out, calclimateag.org. So check that out to learn more and talk to your local policymakers about making sure that your money, the public's money, government taxes, go towards programs that are going to be looking for solutions.
So I know, just to let the listeners know, that Albert Strauss, his mother, Ellen, was the co-founder of the Marin Agricultural Land Trust. And I know that, Albert, you've been very involved in wanting to make sure that agricultural lands are available. So what are some, it does seem like there needs to be some political will or governmental backing in order to be able to solve the problem of the land here is too valuable, as you know, most of us can barely afford to hang in living here, and most of the homes here, 70% I think of the homes in Inverness, are second homes. So what are some of the things, you're sort of facing this next generation of issue, like malt helps in one way, but then we still have all these other issues.
Yeah, I think that the solutions, it's really hard to make national change and even harder, well, as hard to make state changes. I'm thinking that local, how can we work as a community and locally to make change here to help the next generation and make change in the current generation? So between working with malt to see how there's innovative ideas to get land available for people that want to grow crops or livestock, to just kind of working on different ways of getting everybody in the community to think differently and looking at resources, and a very supportive community that wants to buy high quality organic products. So bringing everybody together and coming up with a common solution that benefits everybody.
So I would like to speak in my own personal context. We don't have enough water on our ranch to support row crops. So there's just a physical limit to what that land can support. So our decision was to introduce grazing animals, but that's a challenge, water. And as we go into drought, the idea of putting in crops and food production systems is important, but we hit instant barriers.
Might have to grow potatoes.
Yeah, that would work.
Dry farm those, the Bodega Reds that are the old heirloom potatoes brought back. But that's an interesting thing, because when we first started the show at noon, talking about this, you know, sort of mindset that eat less meat, go vegan, grow more crops, that's what would help our climate change and climate issues. Whereas really you want to use the land for what its best use would be for. So out here, it is grasses and grazing land. And, you know, somewhere else where you have more regular rains is where you would probably want row crops. You know, I'd be interested in what James has to say in terms of permaculture with these kinds of issues.
Well, yeah, I think you're touching on it. Like, as the humanity needs to re-examine, like, where we are. We all left Africa and we're spread all out and then created 8 billion people. And now then we put our heads up, how are we going to produce food? And it's where. And the assessment of what the land is best for, and how do you make that assessment? And then how do you shuffle all the moving parts? You know, how do you move the cotton farming out of Arizona, which is totally crazy? And so, you know, that will be, it comes down to having where's the support structure going to be to support the farmers who link them to what they want to grow, and to link them to the land that's appropriate for that, and that assessment. But that takes big planning, because we're operating on a system. I grew up in a family farm. You know, okay, so this is my family farm. It's been there for 150 years. Well, I'm staked here. So then you try to make the best out of what that thing is and that piece of land will support. So in a permaculture sense and an ecological sense, it's really doing the assessment, like John just mentioned. Well, what can happen here, and what would be crazy to do, wouldn't support long-range regenerative capacity of that land. So, you know, permaculturally, you know, if permaculture, the role of it is strong in what is the small-scale, diverse yield, high-intensive, what role does that have? And just as Evan was mentioning that we're up against the scales of financial viability. And so, you know, how do you have that diversity? Because that intense diversity is really what the ecosystem wants to have. But then how do you create that financial viability in that? So, but it's coming, and you see the examples of it, you know, what Albert's been able to do, and on that level, and others around the country, there's just every day there's just more and more examples of how to mix the pigs with the forest and the chickens and the cows, and integrate those systems in. And permaculture, you know, as Bill Molson says, the leading edge of a 10,000-year-old technology. It's basically like we have a living system and we happen to live on it, and then how do we integrate our needs while maintaining a vibrant ecology around it? And, you know, that's an intergenerational process, and it's energy consumptive, and it doesn't fit well with a middle class who's already extended and losing altitude financially, and time is really scarce. And so, you know, it's about our bigger culture that we're facing. So agriculture can only move so far to the mainstream of what the digital world is unfolding. So, you know, we and permaculturally, we just introduce and encourage people to get in tune with the natural world, and then begin to have a deeper understanding of that, and begin to grow out of that, and supply their needs. And so, I think that the whole future is going to be, as it's been spoken by other people, it's like how do we get the awareness, how do we get the political will to do some of these major changes that need to happen to open up the space for all these emerging technologies. Technologically, we can do it. Will people support it to the point and create the space for the young farmers? How much money do we want to invest in young farmers? Like, if we were really practical, we'd be looking at the military budget and pulling some small incremental amount there, and having support, minimum wage for people who are totally engaged in agriculture to make sure that we have something to eat down the road.
So we're kind of getting towards the close of this show, and I think for each of you guys, Albert, if you wouldn't mind just kind of giving us, like, responding to James and kind of how you're seeing things going next.
So I was just going to say that what I realized is biodynamics is something that marries animals with land, and I think John's incorporated, you know, this model kind of, we need for compost, we need carbon, we need nitrogen, animals have the nitrogen, plants have carbon, and bringing it all back to a system that actually is more self-sustaining on a farm-by-farm basis. So I think that's, you know, I think it's a direction, it's going backwards, but it's going forward. So I think it's a good direction, and he can quantify what the changes are, and actually help farmers be more sustainable by compensating for their practices.
One just quick thing, Albert, that I know from talking to you about the project you've been doing in India, that one of the things that when you started to describe some of the practices you wanted these people raising the cows to practice, they said, oh, now we get it. You mean like our grandfathers did it. Mm-hmm. That it was, you know, you were trying to bring them back to, you know, that it wasn't too far back, but that it was innovative and revolutionary for what you were suggesting now in the moment.
Well, India is a totally unique place, but I think it's a lot of the challenges are similar around the world, and that's a long story.
Well, I guess my point is that we innately, as humans, there's a sense that we know what we should be doing. John, would you like to add that?
Yeah, I would definitely challenge that. And I think what's extraordinary about our time is we now have very high resolution observation technologies that we never had before. When I grazed my ranch and looked at the outcome, I was very excited. And I was also confident that I was increasing soil carbon. But by bringing scientists in and actually measuring soil carbon fractionation, it turns out I was losing carbon. This is really bad news, because grazing management alone lost carbon on research plots. That's really bad news, because I'm talking about grass, which grows on grass in grasslands, which are part of rangelands, which are the single largest cover type on Earth. So the single largest cover type on Earth is crashing and becoming a source of greenhouse gas emissions. Whereas when we look at it with our eyeballs, it looks great. So this is our moment. We now have to bring science in, observation through new technologies, and actually understand at a molecular level what's happening. And by doing that, we see exciting things and really great news. That's what we've done. And what we'll continue to do is inform agricultural practices using science and building a suite of practices known to be a solution set. And that's the thrust of our work. And Albert typifies the outcome that we're looking for.
And John, can you once again let our listeners know about the site where they can see that suite of practices?
Oh, sure. It's a USDA webpage. It's called COMET, C-O-M-E-T hyphen planner. And this is a new tool online. And it's a very, very conservative tool. It will give you instant data or numbers based on your acreage and the practice suite that you select and your location. And then that actually will inform you whether you want to do the further work of going in deeper with other tools available like Comet Farm, which the USDA uses as well.
Well, and I know, John, to, and I do stand corrected because I remember Joel Salatin saying one time, if you think we can't do this without technology, it's the marriage of all exactly. of our ancestors with technology that's going to save us. So don't yeah. think you can, you know, go all Amish on me and make yeah. it work. Yeah. So, and then Evan, would you like to kind of give us your wrap up and also let us know where we can check out the Farmers Guild? And I know you've got your new Follow the Rooster program people can check out.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess the last point I would want to make is that we are at a really interesting point in this whole movement, that there is a mainstream shift towards wanting to do better by our food, by our bodies, by our ecosystem. You know, the fact is you can it's hard to go anywhere without seeing enormous signs that say sustainable, signs that say local, signs that say all the ideals that we collectively hold as a culture. And so the good news about all that is that people really do care, because if for instance Safeway is putting up signs that say support your neighborhood farmer, that means they've done a survey and they found out that that's what consumers are interested in. That's the good news, is that it signifies that it has hit the mainstream. The bad news, or at least the challenge that we're up against, is that there's a conversation that's taking place primarily amongst the kinds of people you're hearing here on the radio show, but that conversation is gradually being co-opted by marketers of every single kind, whether it's the wine industry or it's the enormous $50 billion grocery store chains. So we have to make sure that we as consumers, we as community members, make sure that those words have some accountability and integrity to them, and not let the marketers do the job for us. On that note, I'd love for people to join us at the Farmers Guild. We have monthly meetings in Petaluma and Spatpole. We put on lots of events throughout the year, from our Farmer Olympics to our Farmers Guild raising in February. And we also have a new program called Follow the Rooster, followtherooster.com, which is an opportunity to map and tell the story of people and businesses that really are supporting the next generation of sustainable agriculture. So check it out. Hope to see you there, and I appreciate you having me on the show today.
Great. Well, thank you to everybody that was on today, and I know Bing's going to be talking about the climate calendar and some events coming up.
Yeah, I'd like to thank our guests, John Wick of the Marin Carbon Project, Alan Albert Strauss Family Creamery, Evan of the Farmers Guild, and James Stark, Regenerative Design. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting.